Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, and maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I'm similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go
I'm on the line here, so.
And check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the further you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're on the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator's screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the limit and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very, very much for the time that you provided us with that disclaimer. And it's my pleasure to share with you tonight some very, very interesting things. This doesn't happen often, but tonight we have the sincere pleasure of introducing to you a new information provider. Not new in the scheme of things. This information provider has been in this facet of law for nearly 30 years. And has, shall we say, perfected everything by now. In fact, it was perfected a good 13, 14 years ago. But before we get into that, and before we bring PJ into the group here, I want to share with some of you that may be disappointed that we're looking for further glue that or adhesions, that whatever entanglements that the feds have for us as citizens of one of the freely associated compact states to tell them that we're federal citizens instead. We're not going to do that tonight. We'll resume that next week and can continue through these lessons. But for tonight, I do have a short monologue I want to share with you. This monologue is produced by a gentleman. He wrote, Paul Mitchell wrote this, and I read it, and I go, my gosh, this is exactly what these people need here tonight. And I got it this afternoon in the mail. So it was just wonderful that how the Almighty One puts things into perfect timing. It's time to cry foul, folks. Whenever any politician or other government employee repeats their misplaced worship for, quote, our democracy, end quote, and all similarly misguided nomenclature, after 32 years decoding the selfish rhetoric which insulates that term from accurate and objective scrutiny, permit us now to summarize the essential results of that decoding exercise. As explained in much greater detail elsewhere on the Internet through the Supreme Law Library, there are three key findings that form the foundation for the proof of this statement. One, federal citizenship is a municipal franchise legally domiciled in the District of Columbia where the guarantee clause does not apply when strictly construed. Number two, the population of federal citizens who now inhabit the 50 states of the Union are, by corrupt legal definitions, an absolute legislative democracy that is, quote, subject to, end quote, all federal municipal laws. And then lastly, thirdly, being another federal municipal law, the 1866 Civil Rights Act did not and could not amend any of the six clauses in the United States Constitution that expressly recognizes the primary class of state citizenship, otherwise known as Citizens of the States United. If the listeners here already suspect that something is terribly amiss in such a corruption of plain English, they would be entirely correct with that suspicion. We remain immensely grateful to Judge Pablo de la Guerra, who explained clearly that United States in all three qualification clauses means states. A citizen of the United States is a citizen of one of the states united by and under the Constitution, reference the Bidwell decision of 1901, the Hooven decision of 1945, as well as Black's Law 6th dictionary definitions. In our studied opinion, the quickest and the best way to demonstrate that corruption is to recognize the far-reaching legal and historical ramifications that were spawned when the U.S. Congress extended the entire Constitution into D.C., the District of Columbia, in the year 1871, otherwise known as the Act of 1871. To put it bluntly, that extension statute had the unavoidable consequence of reinforcing the blueprint established by the framers. That blueprint can and should be understood to prevent the federal government from exercising any sort of municipal authority inside any of the now 50 states of the Union. Therefore, it is not too great a leap for federal citizens to realize that their decision to live and work in one of the 50 states necessarily means that they are not, quote, subject to, end quote, any municipal laws which Congress has already enacted for places like Washington, D.C., Guam, the Virgin Islands, the American Samoas, and, of course, Puerto Rico. If Congress decided to change the fine for a parking meter violation in the District of Columbia, that fine statute flatly cannot be enforced anywhere inside the 50 states. In point of historical fact, the crucial phrase, quote, subject to, end quote, it has its distant origins in the British monarchy, where all inhabitants of the United Kingdom remain subjects of their king or queen, even to this day. That key phrase was introduced into American legal history by demonstrably vague and deliberately misleading language that was chosen for Section 1 of the so-called 14th Amendment proposal. In that failed proposal, quote, to the jurisdiction thereof, end quote, is correctly understood to mean, quote, subject to the municipal jurisdiction, end quote, of the federal government. It can't mean anything else, obviously, because the jurisdiction of each state is also mentioned expressly in the latter half of the same Section 1. To demonstrate the latter point with a very relevant example, the Constitution does not confer upon the Congress the power to make nationwide decisions about education. Congress can do so for the federal zone. That term was coined in a book by the same title. Congress is not obligated to guarantee a Republican form of government to that federal zone. It was free to create a different form of government there, and so it has. Does the word democracy mean anything to you? However, matters like education were always intended to be decided by the legislatures of each Union state. Alabama's legislature can enact municipal laws that govern education in Alabama if they want to. Wyoming's legislature can enact municipal laws that govern education in Wyoming if they want to. And, of course, you can go to the other 48 states and say the same thing. However, by intent of the framers, as formalized in the organic United States Constitution, enacting nationwide laws governing education is not one of the enumerated national powers that are conferred upon the Congress by Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. Every listener here should pause and reread and study Section 8 to drive home the enormous significance of that fundamental law in America. If America as a nation sincerely wishes to halt the steady slide down that slippery slope, correctly diagnosed as, quote, a legislative democracy, end quote, the inhabitants of all 50 states will need to rise up and assert their fundamental right to be immune from all federal municipal laws. Those 50 states are not, quote, states within a state, end quote, and they are not, quote, special definitions of state, end quote, either. such municipal laws cannot lawfully be enforced anywhere inside the 50 states of the Union without violating the very blueprint published by our framers when they put their plans in writing and chose a republic, quote, if you can keep it, end quote. If you don't fight for it, if you don't assert your right to live and work in a constitutional republic, you will not keep it. You will simply lose it. That was Benjamin Franklin's serious warning for America, and although I hesitate to claim any special knowledge of the future, I do happen to agree with his conviction, mainly because it's happening before our very eyes. Again, this was a comments written by Paul Andrew Mitchell, and their keeper. I'll be using that for every call that we will be introducing our new information to provider to on his Monday night calls. We have Monday set up for GW, and he will be presenting the Changing Our Status process, which we'll talk about a little bit tonight. But before we bring GW aboard, let me just say that I had somebody email today and says, why are you always using initials? And the answer is simply this. In the near 30 years that I've been marketing people who have unique and specific skill sets in law, three of them have died under strange circumstances. Two of them were at the point where they were bringing questions before the states, before the United States Supreme Court regarding the validity of Title 18. So I'm not interested in advertising names out anymore. We're simply going by initials, and you'll just have to be comfortable with that. With that having been said, let me now introduce, bring forward PJ. Hello, PJ.
Hey, oops.
Yep, I hear you.
Hello?
You're fine.
Oh, okay. I thought I had it on mute there. Go ahead.
Nope, you were perfect the first time. Yeah, PJ, this is going to be a little strange night tonight, as I gave you a heads up the other day about. We're bringing forward GW. GW, you want to say hello?
Hello, everyone.
There you go.
Hello.
And, PJ, you heard the talk tonight that I gave, the presentation from the other gentleman's writing. Let's hear what Greg has to say with regards to what it means to change your status and why. And then we'll like to come in and join you in and GW together for your own voidire, if you would, of GW's work and so forth. And then we'll open it up to Q&A for everyone. How's that sound?
Sounds good. I'll be muted out okay. So that we don't get any traffic background from me. Okay.
All right. I'll tell you what. Let me mute you on my end, okay?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
All right. That way you don't have to worry about it. All right. GW, so tell us what...
Yes, sir.
Tell us what it is that you do and why, please.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, thank you for having me on tonight, and we're going to talk about something that's really near and dear to my heart. I do it every day. It is something that when I finally, I didn't discover it, when I finally came into the understanding of this through some very benevolent people that helped me down this road, It was mind blowing, and even at first I didn't believe it. So it was something what we're going to talk about literally, okay, figuratively and literally, if you can imagine this, is really the key that unlocks the matrix of this legal system when you're operating on both sides, you know, just like the movie The Matrix. And you had Morpheus who convinced Neo to take the red pill, okay, and to start the process. What Morpheus helped Neo to accomplish was to realize his real power and who he really was. And what we're talking about in a figurative way and also literally is is the key that really unlocks this, and that is correcting your status. Okay? I've searched for years and years, and we've done a lot of work and trying to understand all the minutiae of the Constitution and the laws of the land to try to get a footing against these what you would come to the conclusion of are non-constitutional types of statutes, regulations, codes that we deal with every day in all of the 50 titles of the CFR. And if anybody doesn't know what that is, that's the 50 titles CFR, Code of Federal Regulations, there's only 50. I'll give you an example. There's one that you deal with a lot. I'm sure everybody on this call deals with a lot. That's called Title 26. That's the income tax code, the IRS income tax code. That's Title 26. Title 27 is alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. We could go on and on and on. But for this call, we won't. So when I first was introduced to this information, it was a long time ago, but I didn't have the full scope. I talked about it. I liked the idea, but I didn't understand where I needed to go to correct my status and standing. Okay? And there is a place to go where you need to go to correct your status and standing. It's the highest office in the land. We're not going to discuss it here. But once I learned about this, and that was actually after a lot of very dramatic things happened in my life. And once I learned about it and I corrected my status and standing, I was attacked. I mean, three separate times. Now, I'm not gonna go over the story right now. Maybe we'll go over it on the Monday call. But I was attacked by the IRS, drug into the IRS. I was attacked by the CID, that's the Criminal Investigation Division of the IRS, the one guys that wear the badges and the guns. And then I was summoned in, and I won't say attacked, but I was brought into the Justice Department. And every single time, with my corrected status and standing, and knowing how to assert it, and what I call weaponizing your paperwork, they put their tails between their legs and they had to go. It never moved to a court situation. It never moved to arrest. It was very powerful. I give you this illustration of this, and I hope I can bring this up, Michael, on this line with people. You know, my faith in God is absolute. I have an absolute faith in God and my Savior Jesus Christ. I used to believe that God could heal. And I believed it and believed it and believed it. And there was a point in my life where I prayed and fasted. And it was several days. And I had a miraculous healing. I no longer believed. I now know God heals. Well, with this, what I'm trying to convey here is I no longer believed in the documents and the correcting of my status that it would work. I know it works now, because of what I went through. And so I want to tell you that there's a lot of patriot myth out there. There's a lot of stories. There's a lot of gurus that have you jumping through all different kinds of hoops to do things and to try to get an edge or get into the right position. A lot of it is shadow boxing, okay? Doing a lot of busy work that in the end doesn't work. So what I want to say is there's a lot of benefits. There's a ton of benefits for correcting your status. I think we probably, on the talk on Monday night, we'll probably get into those benefits. And we don't even need to talk about all those benefits, because I'm a big believer in I listen, I despise over-promising and under-delivering. And I'm sure there's a lot of people on the call that have been involved in different aspects of marketing programs where they over-promised and they under-delivered. I'm one of the, I can't stand that. But I'll tell you what, we in the end will over-deliver and we're going to under-promise. But what we can tell you about correcting your status and standing, just some of the things that we will tell you about will blow your mind. So with that said, do you want me to carry on anymore there, Michael?
I had to unmute myself. Oh, please. Yeah.
Okay.
You better go on for whatever you just, you're making a presentation for the first time, introducing yourself, and then we'll bring PJ here and he can ask you some questions and we'll go back and forth and we'll open it up to the lines. But ladies and gentlemen, we're going to do this again Saturday night with Judge Bernie's teleconference call, The Ultimate in Asset Protection. And then that Monday, the following Monday, the 7th of March, GW here has his own show. PJ has it on Tuesday. GW has it on Monday. And you need to be there or be square. Go ahead.
Well, is there anything that maybe we ought to bring PJ in if he wants to ask some questions or whatnot?
All right. Real
okay.
Good. PJ, you're on the floor with GW.
Okay. You mentioned that you're correcting your status. And I believe it's more accurately stating that you're challenging an individual as to a claim of status upon you. For example, if the IRS comes against you utilizing Title 26, you know, it's not really your responsibility or duty to correct your status in that situation. It's their, if you do it properly, it's their duty, requirement, responsibility to produce evidence of why, what they rely upon that the written law applies to you as a person, applies to the activity that they're claiming you were involved with as far as generating income, and it also applies where that activity geographically occurred as to the aggregate of the land. So it's not, I don't think it's proper, good communication to actually call it a status. It's more of a challenge for them to produce evidence that what they claim as a legislative written law has force and effect against you, the activity, and the location where they're claiming the activity occurred. Does that make sense? Because I believe that correcting your status in the situations like this is most often more accurately referred to as misconstrued status. You know, for example, the IRS would come after us and say that you're a person required to file and pay taxes. So they're claiming that they have an authority to apply that written law upon you. Not really so much a status. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, and if you're asking that in a question form, I would respond with, absolutely, you are correcting your status so that you have standing, okay, when you rebut their presumption. And by presumption of law, they look at you, if you're born in the United States of America or you've been nationalized, okay, through that process, as a foreigner, you come in and you're nationalized. You are a U.S. citizen. And what we're talking about is correcting your status from a U.S. citizen and becoming what's commonly referred to as a U.S. national. Okay? Now, once you correct your status, okay, and it's on the record, and this is done with an affidavit and a number of other things, but once you do that, here's the good news. All of those 50 titles, like Title 26, they no longer apply to you as that person. You are not that person. the person they're talking about is a person that is a U.S. citizen. So you're not that person anymore. Those statutes, regulations, and the codes no longer apply to you. That's my simple answer.
Where I would present the challenge, if they have any evidence that it ever applied to you.
Well,
one way to look at it. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah. I have a very, very special fellow joining us this evening. I call him Brother John because of a heartfelt sentiment. So let's just call him BJ tonight. And BJ, I've unmuted your phone. BJ is tremendous support to all of the information providers here at Your Remedy is in the Law, providing intelligence and understanding of the law. By golly, just as strong as a Juris Doctorate would give you. So let me bring BJ aboard here to perhaps chime in with this conversation. Go ahead, BJ.
Good evening, sir. Good evening, gentlemen, BJ, G. An honor and a privilege to be on this evening. I had the honor and privilege of actually meeting G probably 25, 30 years ago. And back then, we were at a time when a lot of individuals literally were attempting to correct their status to a U.S. national, not a U.S. citizen. Some of them were even expatriating. And when they change your status on the their paperwork, and it actually is a change, you are now actually, and please, G, correct me if I'm wrong, you're almost in a position of diplomatic status. Is that correct?
Yeah, you could say that.
And to that end, the government itself, you're no longer a registered entity of that government. That and G, correct me if I'm wrong here, but when an individual is born in a birth certificate is issued, there is a there is an account set up and a collateralization of that account made, and in the past, up to the contract with the creature from Jekyll Island, I mean the FRB, you had an account number there that you were actually literally collateralized to. And which technically is an error under the paragraph 2 of the Declaration of Independence, because you're endowed with certain inalienable rights, and those inalienable rights were never surrendered to the hired help. And in this situation, we're correcting your status with the hired help. Does that sound fairly straight?
It's definitely fairly straight. And I, you know, just to touch on a couple of things you said, you know, when it comes to the birth certificate, when it comes to the collateralization, when it comes to their use of it and all the accounts that surround that, I absolutely believe that's true. Now, the good news is, or it could be bad news, but the good news is, that's not your account. the real man, okay, is completely separated from that all caps entity, okay, that they're using, okay, and that they actually have you participating with. So here's the good news about that, because there's so much information out there that you need to cancel and rescind and do a number of different things with all those accounts to be able to attain this corrected status. where they basically are leaving you alone. And that's not true. It really gets down and it boils down to a real simple process. Okay? All the other things that are brought up, including, and I know, I hope I don't step on anybody's toes, but even people that have gone through the process of eliminating or separating their Social Security number and all these things, I got to tell you, I've got clients, I've got friends that have that do this, that have done this for years and years. It doesn't affect the Social Security status. They still get it, okay? And they still have their status changed. Any concern about that is something that's really misplaced when you really learn about it. And to address the issue of expatriation, let's do that for a second. So earlier today, I was on with a gentleman from Dubai. And this man works in Dubai. He goes back and forth to Portugal. He's a U.S. citizen, makes a lot of money over in Dubai, doing IT work, different things like that, blockchain technology. Dubai is quite a place. And he was referred to me by a Portuguese immigration lawyer, because he said that he wanted to expatriate. And that Portuguese lawyer that I happen to have been on multiple phone calls with some of her other clients, she, in me explaining this whole thing to her, she got to the point where she said, can I have all your information? I've got some clients I need to send you. Because there's a lot of people that are not aware that you can be you can be an American working in another country. You can, and you don't have to expatriate to have the best, the best status that there is. And I got to tell you, folks, the best status that there is, okay, is not a U.S. citizen. It is separating yourself from that and being what is often referred to as a U.S. national. Okay, so there is a code section in the IRS code, all right in Title 26, right up front. In fact, it is their jurisdictional statement. And it says in their jurisdictional statement, right up front, there's two code sections that apply to a U.S. national. Everything else completely applies to the U.S. citizen. But these two code sections apply to a U.S. national. Okay? One is being involved in the creation, where you have your signature on a form, of creating a corporate bond that's traded on Wall Street. Okay? So I pretty much can come to the conclusion that probably a lot of people that are on this call, okay, have probably never been involved in creating corporate bonds. All right. The other code section that deals with a national, okay, is the code section for expatriation. And by the way, this has nothing to do with expatriating. You do not want to expatriate. You want to correct your status and go to a higher place. Expatriation is where you say, hey, I want to move to another country. I don't want anything to do with the U.S. anymore. I'm giving up all my citizenship, any rights, anything like that. Taking my stuff and going, and the IRS says, oh, hold on. Yeah, you can expatriate, but a certain amount of your stuff is staying here. So this gentleman he at the end of the conversation, he said, wow. He says, you're the first person that's given me hope. So, and that came from an immigration attorney, by the way. So,
there's been a lot of misperception that's laid on I call them the hired help. This is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And when the people don't have time, aren't capable of, don't have the skills, don't have the training, don't feel safe doing something, they hire help. The longshoremen, FAA air traffic controllers, U.S. forestry workers, Department of Transportation workers, governors, presidents, judges, sheriffs. Oh, by the way, those last four, they're not just hired help, they're temp help. And those inalienable rights that were recognized by our founding fathers in the paragraph 2 of the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, and further recognized in the Ninth Amendment and the Tenth Amendment, that those were never surrendered or abdicated to hired help. Now, the hired help, well, however noble their sentiments and well-meaning they are, have made statements that if they do not get corrected or objected to, lay a burden on our shoulders. Now, right now, getting that status that they've put up there, and see, some of these people, they're not as fine civic, social-minded citizens as we would like them to believe. They would like us to believe. They have other agendas. And there are people that manage money that these family for many, many years. They even took Winston Churchill and took him aside and explained how the first international games were going to commence and terminate. And then the second set of international games, best gaming festivities, were going to commence and terminate. They explained how they were going to have a little fiscal challenge in 1929. Over here, and they even explained to him in advance that not just the date, but the time of the day when the stocks would begin to fail and crash. They were making money off of funding both sides of the conflict. To that end, many of those had already participated in a little financial exercise at a vacation destination called Jekyll Island. They created something to so that they could manage money through fiat currency. JFK didn't die because he was sleeping with the world's most powerful man in the free world. Didn't die because he was sleeping with the same girl that the world's most powerful mob boss was sleeping, and she got pregnant, and they couldn't tell whose child it was. He didn't get dead over a bunch of fireworks inside some holes in the ground 90 miles south of Florida. He got dead because he signed the U.S. Note Act in 1963. We were going back to currency that had intrinsic value. We were going back to the gold standard. His successor, immediately after he was inaugurated, did one thing. He went and rescinded that act. These people mean to collateralize your life and use you for asset controls for a fiat currency. What Mr. G here is doing is showing you how to change the documentation so that you are no longer one of those assets. And from a completely different side of most people's perspective, take you completely out of their reach to the point where statute law, for the most part, no longer will apply.
Correct.
Let me just add something, ladies and gentlemen, that I have made a decision this week. Anyone in the future that will be hiring hiring one of the information providers to assist you in your legal matters in a student teacher relationship, none of them will proceed forward in the future without going through GW's process. And why is that? Because what often referred to as the information providers as the gems in my showcase or the arrows in my quiver, what GW is bringing to the table is giving me that red button to push for a nuclear option, literally. This absolutely, totally destroys their standing and the ground that they that the government leverages to come against you with. Simple as that. So I just want to make it clear that that changing your status is the first step in doing anything in defending your position in any crime, period.
Some of you have heard, some of you have heard a saying, and that comes from a religious text. Says, who has needless bruises? Who has bloodshot eyes? And he who lingers over an improper status with the U.S. government and tends to think that he's doing well.
I like that analogy.
I have a question, John. Okay, let's say that I go into a federal zone and rob a get in a fight on the street. Okay, I'm in a federal zone, basically what they would consider a military base. If I had the status of a national or a man, which I believe is the same thing. The only way they could prosecute me is under common law. Is that correct?
That's not completely correct.
Go ahead, John.
There is statute law that they will prosecute you under, and that they can and they will, and that's felonies. Now, if you have if you're tootling along at 65 and a 35, I've had individuals stop me, review my situation, and say, sir, could you please slow down? Have a nice evening.
What I want to say is, when you're in a situation where there's an injured party, meaning a human being that is injured by you, okay, you stole something from them, you raped them, you bludgeoned them, it's going to be a tough one.
When you have an injured party with justiciable standing that's willing to complain, you will be prosecuted.
Yeah. The minutiae, of what's thrown at most people does not align with that. I mean, we're talking about violations of codes and regulations where it's the state or the federal government claiming that they're the injured party. That's where this really, really nullifies things.
When the corporation, not the aggregate person, but the alter entity, claims that they were injured when they're not a real person, that cannot be allowed to stand. But when you have an aggregate party, meaning an organic man who is injured, that now has justiciable standing. And what we're eliminating is the capacity for the non-aggregate pseudo entity to claim injury and damages against you.
Okay. Let's open it up for Q&A, ladies and gentlemen. Press *2 on your keypad, *2 to raise your hand. I'll see it on my board here, and then I'll unmute your mic. Las Vegas. Michael in Las Vegas, I see you there. We'll come to you in 1 second. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the center of your monitor. You'll see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click inside of it. Type away your comment or your question. Then on the outside, you'll see a place to put your contact information. Then hit submit, and I will be more than happy to give voice to your comment or your question. So our first is Michael, followed by someone in Hawaii, ending in 5368. I will be getting your name, please. And then Theo from Canada. So let's talk with Michael first in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Oh, good evening. I'm organizing a trucker's strike across America. Not really. just a little information, if nobody's ever read about Mandel House, one of Wilson's private advisors, they should take the time to read about Mandel House. The man made the statement that not one man in a million would understand or figure out what they were doing. And that was a prelude to Jekyll Island.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's corrupt to the core.
But
anyway, take
Michael.
On with
yes,
the.
You have a question?
I just wanted to throw that at you.
All right, thank you. Appreciate that. You're absolutely spot on. One moment. Next is Party Unknown from Hawaii. First name, please. Whoops, I just muted you again. Go ahead. First name, please. Hawaii.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, first name, please.
Giselle.
Who?
Giselle.
Giselle.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty name. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So I'm new to this call, so I had some questions, and it's probably answered before, but why would someone want to change their status from a U.S. citizenship to a U.S. national?
Were you listening to the whole call, or did you just come in at just now?
I think it's mostly to do with the fact that I'm new, so I don't really understand much of what's being said. So to kind of like dumb it down for me, I guess.
All right, yeah, I'll make it very simple for you, Giselle. As a federal citizen. And I have court cases to back this up, so don't roll your eyes and get upset with me. I'm giving you court cases if you like. But number one, as a federal citizen, your property.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, if you're property, you're a slave. Number three, they can do anything to you they want to because you don't have rights from the creator of the universe. You have privileges from the federal government through the Congress. That's all you've got.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it's been since the Civil War we fought in the 1860s. That's the simple nuts and bolts of it.
Okay.
So by changing your status from a U.S. citizen to a U.S. national, or otherwise known as a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states, you're coming back into the acknowledgement by the federal government. You never left it, but you're now being acknowledged by the federal government to be one of the Almighty One's creations with rights mm-hmm. that he brought to you that preceded even the organization of our country from the beginning of time. So that's why you want to change your
Giselle.
Okay.
That's
and then how
right.
would you go about changing that?
Let me make a comment here real quick. Okay, PJ's talking now. One way to look at it is when the United States agent comes against you, he's acting on presumed authority. And if a lawyer told me years ago that if you do not state your jurisdiction, they will state one for you.
Mm-hmm.
So as John talked about, that the jurisdiction of mm-hmm. the land is the jurisdiction of the people. The jurisdiction of the people is the highest jurisdiction in the land, and it's the one protected by biblical standards with the best protection, and all the Bill of Rights is afforded to you. That is the jurisdiction that you want to claim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you do not claim that, they will claim one for you. And they will never claim the one for you that makes it most difficult for them to prosecute.
Mm-hmm.
they will always treat you as a U.S. citizen. If they can treat you as a U.S. citizen, the jury does not have the authority to determine the law and the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They do it administratively. The judge participates greatly. And as we've experienced in many of the cases that we're dealing with just in the last 6 months or a year, the judge, these judges are getting so corrupt that they're blocking this very evidence that would cause the jury to have great difficulty in convicting you in a in what they would call a federal crime, like example Title 26. So it's very dangerous to go in there in the jurisdiction of a U.S. citizen, which is administratively, because you don't have the protection of the Bill of Rights, and it's much easier for them to prosecute you because the jury just rubber stamps everything the judge does and off to jail you go. Whereas in common law, the jury has a great many questions.
Mm-hmm.
And you can work it in such a way that you can show them that, hey, the government's up to no good here. Let me explain why. Whereas in the other court proceeding, the judge would cut in and say, we're not going to allow you to do that.
Yeah. Let me explain something real fast about jurisdictional issues. When you correct your status and you know how to assert it, and it was Julin, I think you said your name was? Julin?
Giselle.
Okay. Giselle. All right. When you change your status, okay, not that you're a person that gets litigated. I'm not trying to imply that in any way. But I want to tell you from firsthand experience, when you have your paperwork and it's perfected and it's lodged with the right agency, they do not want you, they do not want me in their court for any reason. They do not want this getting adjudicated. They do not want me there because, for one thing, if I know how to handle myself and I demand to be tried by a jury of my peers, my peers are not going to be U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be U.S. nationals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one thing they don't want to deal with right away anyway. But they will do almost anything to get you out of their court.
Okay.
And that's a powerful, powerful tool to have.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Would that have, like, any negative effects on, like, everything that goes on with, you know, the rest of your life? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if that makes sense, but, you know, how, like, there are laws or whatever that you have to go abide by. Like, would you be, like, you know, is it, like, illegal, I guess is what I was saying. Like, how is it, I guess, like, legal for us to change our statuses from a U.S. citizen to a U.S. national?
Well, for one thing, the government cannot dictate who you are. They cannot stop you from asserting who you are. They can presume, and they do that through presumption of law. But they cannot rebut your affidavit that you bring forward. And one of the things that we do, and one of the things that we'll do in our, at some point when we put out the presentation, is show people point blank these statements by the Supreme Court, the appellate courts, where they say this, where they talk about the two distinct citizenships in America.
Okay.
They talk about this. They explain it. And so they can't. They would be looked at as dictators. Now, they are kind of like dictators, but they don't want to be looked at as dictators.
Right.
So they cannot force a status on you. They can presume, and they can let you through deception. They've taught everybody to pretty much talk about how they're a U.S. citizen. You know, another little caveat here is there wasn't anything called a U.S. citizen before 1868. And the 14th Amendment to the Constitution created the status of the U.S. citizen and By the way, if you can transport yourself back to that time,
mm-hmm.
okay, in 1868, the only people that signed up to become a U.S. citizen at that time were black former slaves.
Mm-hmm.
They were seeking special protections from the federal government because they had been a slave.
Yeah.
Now, that changed over time when, you know, through the art of words and deception and everything else, especially around the turn of the century, they were distracted with so many other things that everybody just started to fall in and started to apply for and say, yes, I'm a U.S. citizen.
Okay. So, like, if you get the U.S. national, you'll still be able to do everything that you do now, right? Like, there won't be any sort of limitations or anything?
There's not only are there no limitations, you broaden your horizons by so much of what you can do.
Right.
Yes.
And then so how would you go about changing status?
Well, that's something you need to get together with Michael. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. We're gonna go full bore. Tonight's just meet your new dance partner night. It's just an introduction.
Okay,
great
cool.
question.
Thank you.
Great questions, Giselle. I just sent you a text. If the phone number you're calling in on is a cell phone, look at your text, and if you reply, I'll get that to you. Thank you so much. Next is Theo, followed by Kingfish, followed by Brent, followed by Norman, and Michael making a trip. So let us go to Theo. Go ahead, guy.
Good day, good day. And how are you doing tonight?
Fantastic.
Good. Welcome to everybody. I'm calling from the Great White North, and it is white. We have snow on the ground. My question is for Canadians. There's a few listening tonight. How would this apply to the Canadians, and will they be able to change their status since we are members of a colony under the 11th article?
Theo, I've got some bad news for you. In the entire history of the world that I'm aware of, only at one time, once, did a king concede to his former enemy combatants his property, seceded his sovereignty from them, and referred to them as his peer.
Yeah,
that
I know
King
what
George
you're
III.
About.
That
yeah.
was King George III and the Articles of the Treaty of Paris or Treaty of Peace, whichever you prefer to call it. So Canadians are subject to the Queen still, and so is the rest of the people throughout the world are either subjects to a monarch or subjects to a dictator or subjects to an oligarchy or some other form. It's only the American people that have, or those, the word come in here, that have the opportunity to enjoy their co-sovereignty with other sovereigns in this land and enjoy all of their natural organic rights from the creator of the universe. Canadians have to force Britain to do the same thing today that King George III did a couple hundred years ago, 250 years ago.
So are you saying I have to become a U.S. citizen first and then I can make this move?
Oh, yeah, you could become a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Immediately upon you naturalizing, the good news is immediately upon you doing it, you can change your status.
Perfect. Awesome.
John, do you agree with that? That's the first time I've ever heard something like that.
There's this government was established under a unique premise that there was, as Michael so carefully pointed out, a monarch or oligarch or et cetera were not the premise. It was under the discussion about a democracy, that's a lie right out of the pit of hell, out of Satan's mouth. There is no such thing as democracy in America. This is a republic. It's democracy is mob rule. Republic is rule under God's law. And a premise to that. This government was formed after that. And to that end, in the very founding documents, completely apart from all of the different types of governments that are established worldwide, including the Crown of England and Canada, etc., they recognize conveyance through some form of royalty or conveyance through some form of monarchy or oligarchy, etc. This is the only one that was started, and it's recognized in the Declaration of Independence in the second paragraph. It says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed with inalienable rights by their creator. This one government, unlike, say, England, who the head of the church is actually still recognized as the king. And so in some people, they tend to then man made God in his own image. They recognize their leaders as not just their king, but their God. Here they recognize the one true real God. And this is the only one that hasn't sought a king, although Israel does recognize their God. They also always tried to put a king on the throne, which muddied up the water very, very badly. There are rights that are available here that are not available elsewhere.
Well, I guess I have a new song then. Coming to America. You know who sings that one, and it's loud.
Yeah.
I always thought there was a premise in biblical premise where you could come into a country and actually come in as a man and remain a man and be a free man, regardless of where on God's green earth you were born. So that's good to know.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you've ever wondered what the true definition is of American exceptionalism, you just heard it. Theo, is there anything else?
Nope, that's it for today. Thank you
kindly. I can't wait for this one. This is bring on the Kingfisher. Come on, guy.
Hey, how's it going? How's everyone? Can you hear me?
Fantastic, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Loud and clear.
Okay, great. I have basically two questions or topics. The first is there a distinguishment between an American national versus a U.S. national? Because my comprehension, and correct me if I'm wrong, but
same thing.
Title VIII. Okay, because in Title VIII, it talks about a U.S. national being someone that was born on one of the islands that does not have citizenship, but it defaults to national or U.S. national. Yeah.
Yes. Non-citizen national. So there is a document that we go over during the presentation that comes right off their website, and it's made to obscure and to get you off the track a little bit. So there would be no time that you would ever use that and refer to yourself. If you corrected your status to a U.S. national, you would never refer to yourself as being a non-citizen national. That is only, by the way, for American Samoa, basically.
Right.
So, and there's a lot to that, okay. And they did that, I believe they did that on purpose, okay. I mean, we could go into this story for a long, long ways, but I believe they did that on purpose just so they could put that in there, okay, because there's not a lot of them, you know. They did that to obfuscate, yeah, they did that to kind of get people off track so that when they would hear that, they would immediately go, oh, that's an American Samoan. Okay. So, and then, by the way, there's, when you hear the term non-resident alien, okay, that refers to only, you would use that, but that would only refer to one code, one title, and you could probably figure out which title that is. That's Title 26.
Title 26.
Yeah. Outside of that, it wouldn't refer to anywhere else, but you could use that and state that, you know, that you are a non-resident alien in reference or in relationship to the U.S.
Okay. My second topic is in your process, when someone surrenders their person to the territorial trustee or the commander in chief, and they become stateless and protected under the Hague, is that component part of your curriculum?
No.
Okay.
No.
Can you expand on that? Why you're asking that question?
Well, okay. So, for instance, if I was to say I was a citizen, I would say that I'm a citizen of the Kingdom of Heaven. But
there you go.
Now, but at the same time, I would have a nationality from the country that I came from, California in this case. But at the same time, the person, once is surrendered, then is supposed to be protected under the Hague, and it's like taking your game piece off of the game board. And you become heir to combat, or something like that. It's kind of like being wounded on the game board and taken off and protected by the under the law of nations.
Well, good luck with that.
There's a heavy breathing on a microphone. Could somebody adjust that?
Yeah, somebody. Their mic? Yeah.
That's GW.
Oh, was it me?
May I make a comment here? The United States written law in the Northwest Ordinance clearly indicates that the free inhabitant is to be protected the same as the I can't remember exactly what they call it, but basically the state person. So when you when you're traveling through a federal zone and they stop you and they and you got fear that they're going to abuse you because you're not acknowledging that you're a U.S. citizen, they're forbidden by law to do that. They have to give you the same or more protection than their own persons, if that
right.
helps.
Yeah. Okay, so my last little pitch on this is, does the Trading with the Enemy Act play a role in any of your process? Okay.
Well, the Trading of the Enemy Act is what made every U.S. citizen an enemy.
If
you really search that one out, if you go down that rabbit hole, you will find that the Trading of the Enemy Act is basically a total lie that made every U.S. citizen an enemy.
Yeah, that's the elephant in the room, I say.
Well, Kingfish, that was a great set of questions. I appreciate you. I hope you share with your friends. You've got from what I understand, you have quite a list of associates. If you'd share with them this phone number and PIN number, we will be having another introductory call this Saturday on Judge Bernie's call. And then Monday, we're going full tilt with GW's weekly calls. Okay?
Yeah, I look forward to it. And, yes, I will certainly pass it along.
I appreciate that. In fact, I ask everyone on this call tonight be so kind as to share your enthusiasm and this phone number and PIN number, and inviting people on the call Saturday if you want for another introduction, as well as Monday for the fixed call. Next is Brent, followed by Norman, followed by Michael again, followed by Daniel, followed by Jennifer Sue. So here we go, Brent.
Hey, Michael. Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it. And thank you, all you people knowledgeable in the law, guests. I really appreciate your wisdom and experience. So my question is, we go through this process and correct our status. Several questions regarding the nuts and bolts of our life. You know, how does that affect our employment? How does that affect paying our mortgage? How does that affect our banking? All that kind of stuff.
Okay, to follow up with Brent, I'm going to ask somebody, GW or BJ, to talk about the W-8 form in regards to working for somebody.
I can mention the W-8 form. Normally, when you're employed, they throw a W-9 form at you, and that is to basically tell them why they should take taxes out of your wages. Now, a W-8 form is a form that allows to have a accompanying affidavit. And in this accompanying affidavit, they don't have any forms for a non-U.S. person. Why would they? That's all they work with. If you work with them, you're going to be treated as a U.S. person. Okay, now the W-8 form is for a U.S. person, but it allows you to use that form to basically to correct misunderstandings of being treated as a U.S. person. A U.S. person is required to have taxes withdrawn. An American national does not. So what we do is correct. We present the W-8 form. We've done this for many years. The W-8 form is given to the employer. The employer, the document in itself says that the employer does not have to send this to the IRS, but he's to keep it on file. If the IRS ever inquires, he can present that as prima facie evidence that he has evidence that he's not required to withhold. Now, if you lied to him in that affidavit, he can use that document to say, hey, my hands are clean. Go after him. He's the one that caused a disruption of basically contractual obligation to you guys, not me. But anyway, that's what you use, a W-8, not a W-9. We've been using that for 20 years. 20 years without fail.
Yep.
May I offer a supposition in support of PJ's comment there?
Please.
26 USC has an unbelievable, almost unfathomable amount of substatutes in it. But two very common statutes that are very, very helpful is the Code 6203, which asks them to define what your liability is, but more so 7203, not 6203, 26 U.S.C. 7203. The first three words are very profound, and this is what makes and punctuates Greg's point. And those first three words, does anybody know what those first three words are? Any person required. It's specific, and this statute is willful failure to file a return or supply information or pay tax. And it makes it very clear by those very first three words that there are individuals who are not required.
I'm not that
okay.
person.
What about voting?
Pardon?
I got bad news for you, and I got bad news and good news. What do you want first?
Either one, doesn't matter.
Okay, so one of the things that happens when you correct your status is because the federal elections okay, are found under, and I can't remember the exact title right now, but it's one of the 50 titles, okay, they will eventually yank you off the voter rolls. So this is a way to understand it. They only let their slaves vote for their slave masters, okay? Once you become a U.S. national and you're not property anymore, it's like, we're not going to vote you. You qualify to become an elector, okay, as a U.S. national. I just, for craps and giggles, okay, got involved with a group that was signing people up to be precinct committeemen. And I went to one of their big get-togethers in my local area, and I was talking with some of the people in the kitchen at this big, beautiful home. And there was a guy there who was kind of heading it up, and he had his computer, and he was logging everybody in and signing people up. And they asked me if I'd like to be a precinct committeeman. You know, you should be a precinct committeeman. You could help us. And I'm like, well, okay. I said, but I'm a U.S. national. Changed my status. And he looked, you know, everybody's looking at me funny. Okay. Cross-eyed, the whole bit. And I said, you know, they yank you off the voter rolls when you do that. And I did actually tell them that they only let the slaves, you know, vote for the slave masters. To which they didn't get any applause. They punched my name in, put all my numbers in, and right before their face, the screen disappeared. And the guy sitting there on the computer, he looks to his, you know, to some of the people that he knows, like, what just happened? And then he looks at me and he's like, wow, okay. So, I mean, if you were really excited about voting and you correct your status, it's a toss-up where it's ever, you know, whether you're really it's going to be a provisional vote or not, okay?
May I offer supplemental information and support?
Sure.
The reason they don't want you swimming in their pond, fishing in their pond, or peeing in their pond is because after 1929, they filed the after this little vacation spot event in the 1913, 1911, etc., all the way through Jekyll Island. Part of the plan was to file bankruptcy on behalf of the aggregate United States. And in support of that, what they did was they established a corporation to do business, and that's where the all caps, United, capital States, capital of America, came from. And that was established in 1933, which coincidentally went off the gold standard as well. But your grandparents, your great-grandparents, used to be two ballots at the poll. There was one for landowners, and then there was one for residents. The residents only voted for representatives. The landowners voted for senators and representatives as an elector. Okay. Now, as bad as that sounds, that's the way it was. The last valid elector left off, last duly elected senator, an elector left office in 1938. Now, most judges of any tenure know this. And we've stood in court and say, hey, they pulled this individual's right to vote, and they're a U.S. national. Okay? We want that corrected immediately. And they say, well, I'm sorry, they're not qualified, et cetera. I says, are you saying that they're not a U.S. national? Yeah, we have a passport right here, and that they don't have a right to vote. And what happens is that invariably they say something like, you don't know what you're talking about. And we, amicus curiae, Your Honor, if you indicate that there's another government other than the aggregate government running this, are you willing to go on the record and say that? or are you willing to reaffirm their right to vote? And every single time they've overruled the individuals that erased it and put them back on, with emphasis added.
Wow, that's very interesting, John.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
It is interesting. I was in court once, and they tried to prove up personal jurisdiction, and that's one of the questions the prosecutor asked me if I was a registered voter. Because if you go to registered voter, one of the main lines on that document is to check U.S. citizenship. So go ahead, somebody.
Correct. Well, at that situation, all we did was ask questions. We didn't make any accusations, and we never have. We've never been accusatory. We just asked the judge, the bench, if they were willing to go on record or reinstate this voter's rights. We only ask questions.
Yes. And John's point of never asking questions, I worked with people for 30 years now and close to 100 victories in the IRS arena against the IRS. And that was the number one theme that has accompanied all 100 of these is do not ever say that you're a U.S. citizen. Do not ever say you're not a U.S. citizen. Keep the burden of proof on them completely. Otherwise, it'll come back and haunt you. Go ahead, somebody.
All right, Brent, do you have any other questions?
No, not tonight. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Again, share with your friends the phone number and the PIN number for the call. And if they want, join us Saturday, but definitely come back Monday, okay?
Will do.
Thank you kindly, sir. Next is Norman.
Well, good evening, all. I've been listening, and it's all news to me, so I've got a couple of questions, or at least one. If I change my status from U.S. citizen to U.S. national, does my residence have anything to do with my status?
A resident, by definition, is a U.S. citizen. You have residence. Have your location, your post location. You don't have an address, you have a post location. You don't have a residency. You don't have a residency, you have a home. And if they want to know where your home is, then you can say my post location is. And then I always have a line underneath the city state. I put within the freely associated compact states, because that is a precise quote. Thank you, Jennifer. It's a precise quote from the Congress when they translated Alaska as a territory into one of the freely associated compact states. That was the exact quote they used.
Somebody's doing a lot of stuff with their mic.
If somebody is in a U.S. court, they ask you if you're a resident, they will use the United States statute at large definition for resident. Resident means that you live in land that is a possession or territory of the United States. It's a trick term. Somebody needs to be muted out. They got a shovel on top of their desk.
Yeah, a lot of noise on the line. Okay, Michael.
Yeah, resident's a killer word, and so is county, and so is U.S. citizen. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to just reconfirm what Michael said, that my location is such and such, not my residence.
Correct.
All right. Now, if I change my status, as aforementioned, does any of my paperwork change? My personal paperwork, driver license, and all that kind of stuff.
Why do you need a driver's license?
Yeah, there you go. There.
Why do you need a driver's license?
Well, for convenience.
May I humbly submit and recommend that you get a passport?
I have a passport.
Do you have the passport card?
No.
and I humbly suggest and recommend that you get the passport card to go with the passport. There's a small additional fee. And if you've got a current valid passport, you can get the passport card added to that.
Right.
GW will tell you're going to be turning in that passport that you've had for the last 20 years. Go ahead, GW, you want to explain that?
Yeah. So, you know, a driver's license is you know, proof positive that you're, for one thing, usually a U.S. citizen. And driving is, of course, a commercial activity. So one of the things that I've taught my clients over the years to do and say is that they actually use a card, okay? They actually use their corrected passport card, okay, when they get into a traffic stop and have them run that. And also you don't want to admit or say that you're driving because that's a commercial activity. It's regulated by, you know, it's commerce. And so I travel, and everybody that I know that does this gets that into their common language that they're not driving, they're traveling from point A to point B. And that's what you want to do is you want to travel, not drive. And so,
yeah, I understand. I've been listening to Michael's calls for a while, and I kind of understand all that. But if I'm going down the road traveling in an automobile and I'm in the left seat of the car and in control of the vehicle, and a cop stops me and he says, "Let me see your license," and I hand him a passport card. He says, "This is not a license. I want to see your license." "I'm sorry, sir, that's all I have." "Okay, well, you're going to jail." "Okay."
"No,
so we're going to jail."
No.
Let me finish. And we go through that process, and I understand from previous Michael calls and PJ's calls as well it's no big deal. I can beat that thing, but the inconvenience and the time wasted for all that, I'd like to avoid that at my age. Anyway, go ahead.
May I respond to that, Michael?
Sure.
Please.
Okay. We're going to let's role play for a moment. You can be the judge. And first, you're going to be the officer, and you've stopped me for a taillight out, and you want to see my license and insurance, and you've asked me for that. And do you have a state driver's license? I says, "No, sir, I don't." They immediately says, "Well, how do you drive?" I says, "Well, that's a good question. Did you want an answer?" And, or no, you're just being nice to the kind citizen that you just pulled over. And, no, I want an answer. "No, you're just making communication." "No, give me an answer." "Good question. I'm glad you asked. Let's pretend that you're the judge and I'm the defendant. Okay. And, the officer will be here to testify that I didn't have one. And, I'll ask you, Your Honor, license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, correct?" And the judge will automatically say, "Absolutely." And the officer will as well. And I says, let me see. "So if I don't have this license, I can't go to work. I can't drive to work on Monday or church on Sunday or shopping on Wednesday night, or if my son cuts his foot on a glass bottle. Does that mean that my son goes to die, I can't work, and you're depriving me of my civil rights under color of law? And under, is it the court's opinion, honorable court's opinion, that under 18 U.S.C. 242, deprivation of civil rights under color of law, that would this be a felony? And if the officer is bearing a firearm, that would be a making the arrest, and by the way, they don't arrest you anymore for no driver's license. That's a citation, and unless you're arrogant, unkind, or unpleasant, they or the officer truly is bad, they will not arrest you for an infraction, which no driver's license
True.
Is an infraction.
True.
That is not a crime. Okay, they will not arrest you for that. But and this one officer, this lady was it was a scam, a hit, and claim insurance, you know, bump you and sue you, scam. Luckily, a bunch of other motorists on the roadway saw this lady trying to hit me with four of the people in the car, and I evaded her hitting me three times. The fourth time, she finally contacted my vehicle and then pulled over. A whole bunch of other people had already called 911, unbeknownst to me. This officer, you know, I was calling 911 as well, and he says, well, go ahead and proceed to this place off the freeway, and I waited there for an hour and 48 minutes before anybody showed up. And he showed up with this lady and four other passengers, three men and a child, a baby, an infant. And she claimed that I hit her and that I rammed her. And the officer come over and he says, can I see your license and registration? I says, a Texas driver's license? He goes, yes. I says, I don't have one. He says, how long have you lived in Texas? I says, where do you live? I says, in Texas. He says, how long you lived here? About 30 years. He goes, you know, 90 days you're supposed to have one. And I says, I've heard that too. He goes, well, why don't you have one? I says, well, that's a good question. Did you want an answer? He says, well, certainly. I says, well, I'm glad you asked. And I explained to him that whole thing. He says, you know what? I want to be in court. You know, he says, I'm going to write this lady a ticket, not just write her a ticket. She's going to jail. She's upset me too badly. But if I don't write you a ticket for no Texas driver's license, I'm going to get in trouble with my superiors and the court. Can I write you a ticket? Would that be okay? I said, certainly. It'd be my honor and privilege to accept whatever you choose to write me. And he says, do you want me to actually show up for this? Is it okay if I show up? I want to hear you talk this with the judge. I said, sure, no problem. Come on down. I'm pretty much confined to a wheelchair when I'm in public. Mm. So I had to get to court early, and I'm going in the back way, and I'm in my wheelchair going up the ramp into the back security. And this guy says, wow, you're here early. I says, yeah, I have to get into the court. He says, what's you here for? Ah, no Texas driver. He says, why don't you pay it? I says, well, I'm going to fight it. And he says, you can't fight that. I says, are you asking me or telling me? And he's a U.S. Marshal. And I says, well, I think, you know, and I says, are you asking me or telling me? He goes, I'm telling you. I says, well, what would you say if I said I disagree with you? I didn't tell him I disagreed. I says, what would you say if I disagreed? He goes, well, he started to laugh. He says, okay, tell me your story. And we're still left two or three back in line. And I went through the whole thing with him. He says, I love it. He says, and you're saying that the judge would be committing a federal felony if they tried to, I says, I didn't say anything. You got your smartphone on you? And I says, look up 18 U.S.C. 242. And he says, paraphrased, holy kitty litter, Batman, you know. And he started laughing, and I handed him a plastic cue card that had everything already on it, that I still had one left in my ag bag. And it had 18 U.S.C. 242 and a federal marshal's responsibilities. And he started laughing. He says, I may have to peek in on you. I says, I want to see this for myself. He says, oh, by the way, your citation says court three, but court three, five, six, and eight are all meeting in court six now because they're doing remodeling in the other courts, so expect it to be crowded. I says, well, I'll go up there right away. It's still half an hour before they're supposed to open the doors. And I waited, and I was the first one in. And the bailiff told me, he says, you're going to have to wait in back. You got a wheelchair because we're going to be crowded, and if there's a fire, he says, I'd rather have you the first one out and not have to deal with it. I said, that's fine. He said, but sign in. I'll make sure you're one of the first cases. And so I did. I signed in, and I went to the back. Okay, this court it comes out there are 218 defendants' cases in this court that have signed in by the time the judge is on the bench. The court, there was one or two that they called first, and it's and they called my case, and I wheeled up, and she says, you know, state first so-and-so, you know, and John there, and says, no Texas driver. Says, how do you plead? I says, well, I have a question, Your Honor. And she goes, this isn't trial. Guilty, not guilty, or no contendere, you know. I says, and I just sat there. She says, well, what do you plead? She says, well, I have a question, you know. And she says, you have no Texas driver's license. Or do you have a Texas driver's license? I says, well, that's a good question, Your Honor. Did the honorable court want an answer? And she says, of course I did. And just then one of the prosecutors objected. And says, Your Honor, this is, you know, and she says, hey, look, I just asked him a question. Oh, can you please be quiet? She told the prosecutor that, you know, while he gives me an answer. I says, Your Honor, well, let me see. A license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, correct? And she says, of course. And the female ADA, the district attorney, says, oh, absolutely. And then the male ADA amended it. And it says, but let's get on with this. And I says, so if I don't have that license, that means I can't go to drive a car to get to church on Sunday or work on Monday or go to shopping on Wednesday, or if my son cuts his foot on a glass bottle, I can't take him to the hospital on Tuesday. Does the court consider that a deprivation of civil rights as defined under 18 U.S.C. 242 and a potential federal felony with capital punishment potentially applying? And she says, what do you mean? I says, well, everybody has the right to earn a living and take their children to the hospital when they're in trouble. And we're saying if we got to have a license and you can't take your child to the hospital, now that's deprivation of civil rights and right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And if an officer is arresting somebody, it's implied, the use of force is automatically implied because he carries a weapon. So the death penalty, the capital punishment would apply, and that everyone else is an accessory. And one of the ADAs, he literally said, holy shaving cream, that man. Well, he used the literal vernacular. And the other one, the female, she says, object, object, object. And the judge started to laugh. And she says, you know what, Sonny? And this judge, she was at least 10 years younger than me. She says, you know what, Sonny? I'm just going to summarily dismiss your ticket, you know, because I like your style. And she says, and I said, she started next, and I says, Your Honor, I have one. She says, what are you raising your hand for? I said, well, I have one other question. I says, does that mean you're going to dismiss everybody's ticket here for no Texas driver's license today? And she says, you're asking a lot, Sonny. And she started to laugh, and she says, you know what? How many of you have a no Texas driver's license on your ticket? 2/3 of the people raised their hand. She says, okay, wait a minute. Of you that have your hands up, how many of you is that the only thing on your citation? And you guys stand up, and half of those stood up. A third of the court is standing up, and this is over 70 of them. That was the only thing. She says, okay, we're going to take a 15-minute recess, and I want you, that's the only ticket, to come over to the clerk on this side, and I want the rest of you on the clerk on the other side, because you've got other charges. You're not getting away with those. But I'm going to let this one go, you know. And the clerk raised her hand and says, Your Honor, this isn't going to be a 15-minute thing. This is going to take half an hour and an hour. And she says, okay. And so, and she smiled. She looked down and smiles at me and says, will that be acceptable to you, Sonny? And I smiled at her, and I nodded my head, and I said, thank you, Your Honor. And she pounded her gavel, and as I started to turn around, I did not see her take her robe off. But standing right in front of me at the gate was that federal marshal, you know. And, you know, And I kind of smiled to him, and the district attorney comes over and says, "Where'd you get?" And the judge, she pats me, she puts her hand on my shoulder, and I turn around, and this is, she's over 6 foot, it's a black female judge, and she says, "Was there anything else you wanted to tell me, or what do you mean, Your Honor? Were you going to quote any other sites?" I says, "You mean like Meyer versus State, 1990, and Smith versus State, 1991? And she started busting up and laughing. She says, "I knew you knew that." And she says, "What do you drive on, you know, when, you know, to stay out of trouble?" I says, "Well, I have an International Motors qualification on the Hague Agreement." She says, "Let me see it." And I said, she says, "I've only heard of those." And I showed it to her, you know, and you know, she says, and while she's talking, she says, "I could have found you in contempt, you know." And I says, "Yeah, but a U.S. Marshal wouldn't have allowed you to do that." And she says, "I could have thrown you in my jail." I says, "Yeah, but a U.S. Marshal wouldn't have allowed you to do that." She says, "There isn't a U.S. Marshal. And the one that I met at security opens his jacket, shows her gun and badge, and it's holy kitty litter, Batman." And the ADA says, you know, and then his friend opened his jacket. He brought a friend with him. Totally a God set up. I didn't bring either of those two guys with me. They thought I did. They thought I was loaded for bear. The ADA, you know, and the ADA says, "Well, you know, deprivation of civil rights. Well, you mean the officer could have gone to jail, or possible death penalty, or us and the judge?" And I says, "Yeah, but you know, you guys were trying to do the best job you could, the best way you know how, and you were acting in ignorance. And see, now you're not ignorant, and I'm assuming that this is never going to happen ever again in this court." And I says, "So therefore, I don't have to bother these kind gentlemen with their attention anymore." And both of them have the Cheshire kitty that ate the canary grin on their faces while I'm saying this. They are both just, they're trying to control themselves and not laugh, you know. And all of a sudden, the male ADA says, "Yes, you have my assurance." And he looks at the female ADA and says, "Yep, you got, you know," she goes, "Yep." And the judge says, "Yeah, it was me to go against the grain here." And everybody started laughing, you know, and the marshals says, "John, you need to come up to 7 after you're done. I need to talk to you." And they think I'm in tight with the U.S. Marshals. They left. We talked for about 15, 20 more minutes, left famous friends. 2.5 weeks later, I was in the same court parking lot pushing my wheelchair, and one of those clerks comes running across, and the bailiff, a big black guy, two guns, not just on one side, but two. They says, "Stop, stop, stop." And I'm for certain figuring I'm busted. They says, "We want to talk to you." And I says, "What do you mean?" And she says, "I've been working for that judge for 22 years. And he says, "I've been her bailiff for 26 years, and I've never seen her smile ever, not even in chambers, and let alone laugh in court. Do you know what happened that day when you're in court? Do you know that she hasn't convicted anybody, handed down a guilty verdict or a punish, even when they plead guilty on no Texas driver's license since that happened in 2.5, almost 3 weeks now? You realize she hasn't done that?" You know, and I says, "Really?" You know, and so what happened, that was a few years back, but I've heard that she has since retired due to health problems, but that she never, ever, ever convicted another person of no state driver's license.
Great story. Great story. Thank you. Thank you, John. Norman, any other questions?
No, nothing else. Michael. Thank you much. Good story. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm going to leave your microphone open for a second because I'm going to say something that you may take umbrage with, and I really don't mean it personally to you, but I do mean it personally to everyone listening on this call. Norman made a comment, something to the effect of, and it's a paraphrase or paraquote, "I'm old at my age to get involved with this," whatever it was. And the second that he said that, I was reminded of Samuel Adams that said, quote, if you love wealth better than liberty, the tranquility of servitude better than an animated contest of freedom, go home from us in peace. We ask not your counsels or your arms. Crouch down and lick the hands which feed you. May your chains set lightly upon you, and may posterity forget that you were our. Anyways, and that's to everybody. If we don't fight, we have to. There's nothing else to it. And fighting is the animated contest of freedom in a courtroom. Nothing else. All right, let's go to the next caller.
That was John Adams?
Sam Adams, the beer.
Sam Adams, okay.
The beer guy, yeah. All right, next is Mike again from Las Vegas, Nevada, followed by Daniel and then Jennifer, and that's the end of the call tonight. Go ahead, Michael.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Constitution says conveyance of my choice. And the other thing is I don't believe there's anything that says legal and illegal. I think it's lawful and unlawful.
Great point.
They knew what they were doing.
In the law within the freely associated compact states, it's that which is lawful and that which is unlawful. In the District of Columbia, all territories, possessions, and enclaves, it's what they make legal and illegal, I think.
Absolutely. Corporation.
Yep. All right.
Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there. Thank you.
That was a great throw. Appreciate it. Next is Daniel. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah. How does this apply to someone who's been incarcerated?
PJ here, I'll make a comment. You can investigate if the change in status is not necessarily a change in status. It may be a recognition of your original rights. If you find that they violated your original rights, for example, they didn't follow due process to prosecute you, which they seldom do anymore, that you can actually go back for damages. Because they did not have law to prosecute you and incarcerate you and fine you. Go ahead, Greg.
Oh, I was going to ask, you said been incarcerated or is incarcerated?
Been.
Okay, after. Okay. Okay.
All right.
Well, it's something that I did after I was incarcerated. that's what drove me to change my status in March of 2008. You know, when I got out, I'd been held for 5.5 months without my indictment, and I was in jail. But when I got out, that's when I said, that's never going to happen again. They're never going to be able to do that to me again. And that's when I went full bore into getting everything done. So, I would say, it's good for everybody.
All right, I'd like to just give a few cents on that. First off, go ahead, John.
Go on,
Dan.
Yeah, I mean, it's this person was framed. I sat through the whole trial. Personal friend. Leveled as a sex offender. Well, he hasn't been leveled yet. Okay. So it's a kind of a strange situation. But, you know, I don't know if this would be beneficial in extracting him from that whole mess.
Well, is it ongoing?
Yeah, no. Huh?
Is it ongoing?
Say again? No.
Okay.
No,
Okay, it's past tense. Okay.
Right.
So, yeah, are you talking as far as clearing the record or?
Yeah, clearing the record would be great if we could accomplish that as well.
Yeah, this is
was this gentleman caught with a child or anything like that, or was this basically a setup?
It was a setup.
Okay. Great. So he was guilty of a thought crime, correct?
The way it went down, I mean, what happened is he tried to take the heat off the kid because the kid was really getting abused by the system. And when he did, and this is where I feel he failed, because he took and signed a confession, you know. But 27 years later, after the fact, they go after him. Okay, so it should have been double jeopardy the whole bit, you know, but, you know, it's the guy's struggling. He just got out. They gave him 40 years with 15 to serve, and he just got out probably about, I don't know, 7 months ago.
I suggest that we do a conference call at your earliest convenience with that gentleman, yourself, GW, and PJ, and see if we can't come up with something.
Yeah, we can do that.
All righty. Anything else, Daniel?
No, that's good. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so very, very much. Last batter up. The last from down under. Jennifer.
Good evening, and thanks for this call, Michael, and thanks to all of the wonderful, lawful, smart people that are willing to help us. First of all, how long does it take to go through GW's process of becoming an American national?
There's two time figures. One is just under a month, but I like to tell people 2 months so that I can do what GW talked about, which was under promise and over deliver, but it should be under a month.
And do you think, Michael, that would help me in any of my
situations?
Okay.
Had GW been on the scene to begin with, when you contracted with PJ to teach you, you would have been required to go through GW's process first. There won't be any exceptions in the future, and I'm encouraging everyone on the call tonight that is presently a student of PJ's to do this program. Absolutely. It's just not another thing to help you with. This is atomic bomb being dropped on them in an allegory.
Do you have to not have a social security number and a driver's license if you do, or can you still hold on to them, like to open a bank account or something? Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll start tomorrow, Michael. But I have one more question. Let's just say someone has credit card debt and they've been given a summons, and they have some land in their name. I thought the fact that because the banks aren't legally, lawfully allowed to lend money they don't have, why would they be allowed to take land from me when they weren't allowed to lend me that, or they lent me money they didn't have in the first place? So why would that land be in jeopardy?
Well, we can challenge, as PJ's talking here, we can challenge if they have lawful standing to foreclose or collect or charge, all that. They have to have lawful, Congress can only, and the banking system can only operate constitutionally. They have to have law to, permission, basically, from the people to do what they're doing. If they can't produce that, they don't have standing. So there's a lot of things that enter in. I think in every banking situation, there's probably an element of common law and statutory law combined. I might be wrong there, but I think that's very possible. But they have to produce evidence of standing. They don't have standing to operate. The Federal Reserve System is a military instrument that's supposed to be reserved for military purposes, for emergencies. And we've seen that in the Civil War. Both sides used it. acquire assets to win their objective. They're not allowed to utilize that for daily mortgages. So there's a lot of things you can challenge on that, and they do not want to be pressured. We work with people that actually produce law that shows that they're committing felonies, and they actually meet with people and say, "We never knew that. We don't want to go to jail. What can we do to get this thing resolved?" There's just not one answer to it. It's rather complex. Now, as far as your status goes, I don't know how it would intertwine with that, but the main thing is that if with the proper status, they have to proceed in common law, and they have a terrible time proceeding common law if all the facts are being able to be presented to the jury. That's their biggest fear. They don't have a judge there to protect them from the jury. Mm. But is that dead on, John or Greg?
Well, I think you're correct in your summation of it. When you were talking about property, man, them coming after your property, and these are we're talking about real estate here with homes on the land.
It's just land with it's just bare land, nothing on it.
Okay, it's bare land with nothing on it. Okay, so they're trying to attach that property.
No, she was just served with a lawsuit from a credit card company, and the only exposure that she has, everything that she has is in trusts. And I thought that this was also in a trust, but it wasn't. So they have this at this moment, the opportunity to get judgment and then take this piece of land for that in lieu of the judgment.
Right. Okay. Wow.
All right. One thing I want to bring up for Jennifer is, are you naturalized here, Jennifer?
What does naturalized mean?
You became United States.
I am an American citizen, if that's what you mean. I was Australian, and in 2012, I became American.
Great. Okay. Good enough. And you probably have a U.S. passport, right?
I do have a U.S. and Australian passports, and I also have a global citizen card because I didn't have to go through all the crap when you travel on an airplane.
Okay. Because you have a U.S. passport, it's going to be made much simpler for you, and it'll be correcting the record through that. Am I correct, GW?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I want to thank. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Ready to start tomorrow, Michael? Whatever time you want to set that up.
Yeah, I already forwarded you the initial paperwork when you said that 10 minutes ago. Any other questions?
Okay. No, thank you very much, everybody.
Yeah, GW, I forwarded her the cover sheet and the affidavit. Sheet that you had in the yellow highlights.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Start.
Very good.
I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening, especially PJ for allowing us to interlope on his call with a new information provider. I want to thank our new information GW for being here tonight. Especially want to thank Brother John here for showing up tonight. John, do you want to close us out in any comments? Before we go?
Yeah, there's an old saying, you should know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end therein is death. And when we try to tell somebody something, quite often, they become defensive and the line of communication is done. But if you ask somebody a question, especially if it's the right kind of question, you can provoke them to thought. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make that horse drink. Unless you salt the oats. And by salting the oats in a thought-provoking question, like, Your Honor, is it the court's belief that would this be considered a felony that could put the judge's tenure at risk and the prosecutor at risk if we proceed down this path? If we ask their question respectfully, whether they personally deserve it or not, you know, is irrespective of the fact that because they're in that position of a judge, because they're wearing the gown and wielding the gavel, or the prosecutor or the whatever, they're worthy of respect. If we treat them with the respect that's worthy of the office, a basic premise of human psychology is people have a nasty habit of living up to your expectations. And if your expectations are high, you'd be shocked at how often they live up to them. If you ask thought-provoking questions in the right manner with the right heart and the right spirit, you not only may win them over to your understanding, and they may even take it one step farther, saying, "Holy shaving cream, Batman, this is way wrong, Your Honor. The state's going to move to dismiss on this." I've actually had prosecutors say that after asking federal prosecutors, not just state prosecutors, but I've had federal prosecutors say that this isn't right, Your Honor. The state's going to move to dismiss. And in one case, the judge still didn't get it. And she says, "You can't dismiss. This is the law." You know, and then the prosecutor says, "Look, Your Honor, this truly is a deprivation of civil rights under color of law. And if there was a federal marshal here, one of us would be going to jail." I didn't have to say that. I approached amicus curiae. The prosecutor was saying that to the bench. And, the prosecutor finished up by saying, "Somebody may have to go to jail today, and it's not going to be me." But what happened was that because you asked the right thought-provoking question, now the prosecutor was fighting the case for you. Ask questions. Be kindly, be respectful to some of these people, because it wasn't them that created the situation that is holding you hostage, that you've been collateralized because of the money managers of the world that are playing Monopoly with real streets in downtown New York. Okay, though a man, and I'll sum it up with this: though a man seeks an audience with a judge, it's from God that he gets justice. Don't ever forget that.
Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this evening. You all are welcome to join us this Saturday, same phone number and PIN, same time, only a different speaker. It will be Judge Bernie Beshear, and he will be joining us for another introductory call to that particular group of people, and then we will begin Monday the 7th, March 7th, with GW's scheduled time slot there, and I'm all excited about this. Nothing has got me more excited and thrilled and optimistic about where we're taking this than this correcting your status. Nothing has. It's wonderful. And I appreciate everybody that's joined us tonight. Thank you, Brother John. Thank you, PJ. Thank you, GW. Until next week, or until this Saturday anyways, good night, everybody, and be well.
Sayonara.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.